Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of the second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
Well, that felt good.
It did?
Yeah, I haven't said that in 3 months.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I've got the radio voice, because for those of you who were unaware of my radio history, I worked my way through, actually, I earned money in high school, and then worked my way through college being a radio announcer. We used to call them a radio announcer. Actually, I was a disc jockey part of the time. Back when disc jockey really meant you were on the radio and you played records on the radio, right. And you didn't go and mix stuff together. What was that?
I'm not exactly sure, but I'm going to turn down that little volume thing there. They've been switching things around with us this week.
I think the Russians are hacking into our system. Anyway, the telephone number in here, if you'd like to call and join in our conversation, is area code, of course, 254-773-1400.
We do have a caller who wishes to speak with us on the air.
Okay.
So
that's good luck, caller.
Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, Rick in Salado.
Rick von Salado. No, yeah. Aren't you Rick in Salado or Rick from Salado?
Yeah, I'm from Salado.
You're from Salado. Well, that's in German, that's von.
Yeah, I'm not in the ETJ. I live out way out yonder in the Pawpaw Patch.
Okay. So it's Rick.
You know, with Brer
Rick
Rabbit and Brer Fox.
Rick von Pawpaw Patch.
Pawpaw Patch.
Okay.
Don't throw you in that Brer Patch.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you're enjoying the cool weather and the air conditioning that got dumped down on us from Colorado.
It's just a problem with the allergies. This is the allergy capital of the world, isn't it?
Pretty close.
Everybody gets it about this time. I just wanted to ask you a question about the dip in the, the British pound sterling? Did they have a brief?
You talking about the flash crash or the serious long-term decline? The flash crash. Well, that was either an algorithm that that Al Gore stumbled on.
No.
Oh.
Al-Gore rhythm, see? It was a fat finger or fat thumb or whatever.
But I can tell you with almost no doubt at all that it was an algorithm.
It was algorithm.
Is somebody playing with the world currencies?
It was an accident.
Let me tell you what happened there. This is fun for me, and it may be overly boring for everyone else. But there are computers that are just set to say the algorithm is just a saying when this thing happens, do this other thing. And sometimes the first thing can be really complicated. If we look at the 200-day moving average for the British pound. The moment that the British pound dropped below the 200-day moving average is when
the trigger hit.
Yeah. And it had a drop because it was after hours. Nobody was there to buy. And a computer said, I'm going to sell everything. And probably somebody got fired over that because they lost a lot of money by selling at that speed in that market. The two of the major trades that happened afterwards were canceled. And that the regulatory authorities came in and said these trades were triggered by that trade and it shouldn't have happened because that trade wasn't right. So they canceled the other one, but the first trade stayed. So whoever did it lost a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. They sold.
Who referees all this?
Nobody.
That's a really interesting thing.
The marketplace.
International, it's kind of like the bond market. The international currency trade is even more Wild West than the bond market is. There is no regulator.
There are platforms on which you can have a marketplace so that if you think of it like a supermarket where everybody gets together and all the farmers go to that place to sell and you have one buyer, only it's more like a farmer's market where farmers can buy from other farmers.
Mm-hmm.
They all come together, and there's kind of a loose regulatory authority on that one marketplace. There's lots of marketplaces, though.
You got to be a really, really, really big player, like gazillions of dollars, which is a new number I just cooked up.
That's a very nice. Can I have some of that?
Yeah. And in order to move a national currency, you have to have bongo bucks, gazillions of dollars. You have to be like a George Soros.
And he has
done that several times. He has manipulated.
Yeah.
He has manipulated against the pound in the past. It's perfectly legal. Because
the British don't like him very much.
Right. But the point is that that particular thing, the good news is that the organizations, the private organizations, the commercial organizations that maintain these platforms jumped in and actually headed off a disaster that could have occurred if that trade had triggered a bunch of other trades, and it would have been pretty bad.
I'm showing old Baldy here a picture of the moving average and the point at which the trade happened, and you can see that it is absolutely within split seconds after the average changed.
What is significant is not that really a flash crash. We've had several of them on the markets in the United States where we have regulators, and they are corrected fairly quickly, and I'm really impressed that the system caught this one and corrected it fairly quickly. The news is the fact that in 2007, 2008, In 2008, the British pound was $2, around $2.41 to the dollar. In other words, it took $2.41 to buy a British pound.
Right.
It's currently at $1.23.
One half against the dollar.
And why? Well, A, we had the big recession, but as soon as we started coming out of the recession, the pound started recovering, the British started talking about Brexit.
Yep.
And with, in matter of fact, you can see with the Brexit vote, you can see the sudden drop in the value of the pound. And then you can see the reason, what took it through the 200-day moving average on the way down was Theresa May's speech that says, okay, we're into this, and on March, we're going to start the clock.
Yeah, Theresa May is the Prime Minister of Great Britain, if those of you that are listening didn't know.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question on that?
Sure.
All right. The inverse happens here. Things are cheaper in Great Britain right now, right?
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
No, they're cheaper to buy from Great Britain, but what's happened is the cost of things they import, which is a lot, including oil, has been rising pretty fast. So that if, for instance, that same thing happened in the United States, we do import, if you look at all that stuff that we import from China and we import from some other places because labor is cheap there, all that would have risen about 75% in cost had we followed the same route. In other words, if the same model applied in the United States that has applied to Great Britain, all of those imported items that we bring in, because we frankly don't have enough people here to make all of them, and we buy a lot of stuff in the stores, we would have seen the prices of those things rise dramatically.
And just as a side note,
a long time ago, the German Mark, Deutsche Mark, of course they don't use it anymore.
It is the euro.
More stuff here.
Yeah, well, it was the other way around.
It started getting to
right before the euro came in.
They had more dollars for their marks, right?
Well, what it boiled down to is when I was in Germany, a mark was 40 cents.
Right, yeah, something like that.
And before that, guys were talking about when it was an even quarter, it was 25 cents.
Correct.
And
correct.
The euro is the mark, by the way.
Correct, yeah, I get it.
And it is higher than the dollar. So what's happened is the value of the mark/euro has risen against the dollar as Germany and Europe have recovered from World War II.
Now, there's something.
As soon as the hurricane clears out, then Germans can and Europeans can take vacations in Florida, right, at a cheaper rate?
Not cheaper than recent. No, no.
The euro has been dropping against the dollar consistently, also because of the Brexit, but also, as a side note, they have not reclaimed the kind of dominance they had before the recession.
Yeah.
And by dominance, I'm not saying there's a competition between our currencies. In fact, the Europeans really want their currency to be weaker than it is because the Germans are a net exporter.
Big time.
And they really
want more Americans on the Riviera, right?
Right.
Well,
right.
they actually want to sell more German-made stuff to us.
And to China and to everybody else, for that matter.
One of the things to remember in the big picture here is Europe is still trying to figure out how to get out of the Great Recession. Half the countries in Europe have unemployment rates that approach 30%. The total unemployment rate in Europe is around 10% right now, where ours is 5%. And they are still trying to figure out how to crawl out of a hole. And one of their states, it's kind of like Britain is roughly the equivalent, I guess, in many ways, of Texas to the European Union. One of their states has simply said, "We're leaving,"
and they don't have a constitution.
Yeah,
yeah. So there's nothing that says they can't. In fact, when they do it, it may make them a more viable trade partner than what's going on with the rest of Europe. This is a side note.
I gotta go, so thank you.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for the call. As a side note, the trading atmosphere between the United States and Europe has been getting more and more favorable until about 6 months ago, when it became an election debate in France and then in Germany and now here. We were beginning the process of getting a pretty good trade system between us where we didn't have tariffs on the stuff being shipped back and forth. That would have benefited us both. That would, and this is something people point out, and they're absolutely correct. Free trade does hurt people. It benefits a lot more people than it hurts, though. The people that have lost their job in manufacturing, and both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have pounded on this in a very incorrect way by saying that we exported our jobs to China and that's why the manufacturing jobs went away. And the reality is that our manufacturing has picked up to a level that's above where it was before the Great Recession. It's at a point where it's getting close to the most manufacturing we have ever done in the history of the United States. But the jobs didn't come back with it because catch-all robots.
Mm-hmm. And automation has replaced it. And also, right. It also is in the retail area, too.
Yeah.
This is the point I wasn't even thinking about. I was thinking about the fact that in a given retail store, you see computers and,
right.
and all. I read today, as I was getting ready for this program, a really interesting article in The Economist that said, whoa, it explained it, and it suddenly became clear as a bell. Amazon is computer technology.
Yes.
And it is shutting down retail businesses all over the country. It is threatening, seriously threatening Walmart.
Yeah, and if you look at what's going on in the background in the warehouses in Amazon, it's robots.
Yep. And they're actually using drones in the warehouses right now. I don't know if you knew that or not.
Yeah, I did.
They do
drones
to do the inventory.
Right. They're not drones that are flying. They're drones that roll around and actually pick up boxes, move them around. They've got a lot of flying drones being used for other things.
They
too.
Have the flying drones in the warehouses used to read the barcodes on all the boxes in there so that they know what their inventory. Instead of sending people around with barcode readers like you see in the grocery stores,
send the drones out.
They have drones flying around reading barcodes.
Which, if you're a human walking in there, you might get an extra haircut or two
in
the
process.
Well, they
just keep humans out of there, and that way they don't have to worry about
right.
it.
Right. Okay, we've got a caller on 773-1400. Okay. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning, Jake. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning.
Who are we talking to?
My name is Rick McLean.
Jeff, hi, Rick.
You might remember me from 1982.
I do, and actually, I remember you from before that. You used to wear the same clothes every day to work.
Yes, sir. Used to get lectures about drinking and driving from a man that wore the same clothes to work every day.
And you once looked me square in the eye and said, sir, are you trying to convince me or are you trying to convince yourself?
Yes, sir.
When you were, as I call, the squadron motor officer, weren't you at that point?
Motor sergeant at that point.
Motor sergeant. I'm sorry, motor sergeant. You're right. Anyway, go ahead, Rick. It's good to hear you.
Yeah, Jeff, I'm glad you're back. Didn't know you were gone. I just tuned in a couple of times, and Jake was there by himself.
So what you got?
I was going to thank you for all the things you taught me when you were there as commander and how you addressed the way they treated you when you were in the military, and you've taken good care of my money. I'm still a professional long-haul truck driver.
Well, good.
And they say that we are the gauge of today's economy.
In many ways, you are, right.
And doing heavy haul, obviously the military was or is part of my biggest customers, and business is slow.
Yep. And that's one of the things I think, one of the few things I think Trump has got right. Now, whether he can do anything with it because he's so erratic, I don't know. But I do believe it would be in the best interest of the United States to pump some serious money into the military. We have got old, worn-out equipment, a lot of it left over from the Gulf War in 1991.
But it was cutting edge at the time.
And I don't know if you've heard about the fact that, for example, one of the big headlines recently in some of the periodicals that I read is the fact that the Marines have really, really old helicopters that are falling out of the sky. And they just cannot keep them functioning, and they keep losing people. And their readiness has to be faked Which reminds me of the Army when we you and I were together in the Army.
A little Carterism going on.
We were going to go into that, Jeff.
Yeah, well,
we were going to go into that.
Yeah, but that is the truth, and that's one of the reasons that I got out of the Army is a guy you and I both knew, whose name was Huff, insisted I fake readiness reports.
Yes.
And I told him no, and we got into a bit of a disagreement on that subject. Yeah, I completely agree that the military budgets need to be, and there's a couple of things they need to do. Number one, they need to sit down and think through it. They do occasionally to make sure that this is a smart, that the military budgets are being run in an intelligent fashion. And secondly, and get some of the regulation out the door. And then secondly, we need to seriously do some cap. When we talk about capital investment in the United States that we've been missing, Congress in the sequester. Now, this is a sequester deal. Has cut the military inadvertently, automatically, year after year after year, because they trigger the sequester. And the sequester cuts the military at the same rate domestic gets cut. And we are left, we could easily wind up with a very, very well-trained fighting force with equipment that won't match what the Russians have.
Right. And there's another aspect to this, and this is important. It's difficult to have a conversation about because it sounds like we're saying something negative about the military when it's anything but. It's the opposite. And that is that the military retirement pay right now is about 1.5 times the active duty pay. And in about 11 years, military retirement pay is going to be the entire defense budget. As far as size, that's what killed General Motors. And we've got to start figuring out what to do there so that we can have an effective defense without violating our obligations to people who were bleeding for us. And so we've got to have some hard decisions being made. These are not part of the political debate right now. And that's a bit of a travesty in my mind.
The retirement in the military used to be a good retention tool, as you talk to the younger soldiers and say, don't get out, stay in, get your bennies. And I practiced that. But I was in, Jeff. I was drafted in 1972, and I retired right after the Gulf War in November of 1992, which was a little over 20 years, and I've been retired for 25 years. So even only collecting half of a W-3's paycheck.
Well, you actually have probably, if you add up the numbers, you've actually probably at this point been paid more as a retired W-3 than you got paid totally during the entire time you're on active duty.
Because you started down at the lowest end and came up, and you ended at the high end at the W-3.
And that is a common thing. Right now, the typical military retiree is getting paid a little over two times as much after he or she leaves military service, and they got paid while they were in military service.
And this is the problem with that. First off, please hear me say that the United States is obligated to the military, the people that went and did it. We have made an obligation, and we need to back it up. But we need to look at the way we're obligating ourselves going forward. We can't overdo it. People are living longer. And that's a good thing. It's a fantastic thing that we're living longer. But if we don't update our obligations, we're going to wind up spending 20 times as much on a military retiree than we do on an active duty.
You know, not all military retirees get to retire 20 years and draw their pay. An awful lot of the people who went to the Gulf War and who went to the Southwest Asia sandbox were reservists who got called to active duty. And this is the interesting thing. Those reservists, when they hit 20 years or 30 years,
they don't get to retire at that point.
They leave, but they don't get any pay until they're 62. Their retired pay starts at 62. And very frankly, I think when a person leaves the military, they should get severance of some kind. But at that point, if they say, okay, when you turn 62 would be a good age, although 65 would probably be a better one. At that point, your military retirement pay starts. So you don't have to worry about a retirement. But you do have to go back to work, and we're not going to pay you because technically, I don't know, you may already know this, when a person leaves active duty after 20-plus years of active duty until they turn 62, they are on retainer. That's That's not a retirement. That's actually not retirement. It's retainer. And it when it was originally set up following World War II, the person had to report in every year for a physical and to pass a PT test. And I strongly suspect a lot of military retirees would have a little trouble on the PT test at this point.
I believe you're right.
And, you know, it just got to be something that everybody got. Yeah. And the whole thing needs an overhaul. We need more money and an overhaul. And
this is something that if we privatize that to some way, more like the TSP, which is the tax savings plan, or the idea there is control your own destiny. Pensions don't work the way they used to. People are living too long. The interest rates are too low. You can't function in an environment with Social Security and with military retirement and the civil service retirement ballooning the way it is. We've got to fix it. Let's not wait so long that the fix hurts the people that we're the most obligated to.
One of the reasons I just read from the people who are inside the campaigns and inside Congress right now who are talking about why these issues are not coming up, why the big social deficit in Social Security, military retirements, is because they won't really impact us. I love this. Impact us for 10 years.
And the reality is, if we wait 10 years...
There will be an impact.
There will be an impact. And we can make changes today that are going to allow it to be eased in. It's not a question of if it has to be done. Just like with General Motors, if we're going to be in competition with the rest of the world, period, militarily and in any other way as a country, then we need to have the focus on making sure the active duty is paid properly and ready to go. But we also need to meet the obligations that we have to our retirees. We failed on that obligation in 1904. There was a very large march on Washington that had the active duty military called out with guns pointed at the retirees that were there to look for their...
I thought that was 1934.
There was a 1904 because Theodore Roosevelt sat on a horse with the military.
I know MacArthur at one point sat on a horse, too, with the military. Machine gun set up during the Great Depression.
Right. There are multiple times that this has happened, I suppose. So the concept here, the one in for the Great Depression that MacArthur was in, it was called the Million Man March on Washington. And it didn't wind up being a million men, but that was the label that they put on it. Anyway, that concept is we have obligations to people that earned those obligations, and our duty as citizens is to make sure we can meet those obligations, and we're not doing it right now.
Yeah, the British have run into the same problem, by the way. They have cut regiment after regiment after regiment to where they're really not prepared to go to war at this point in the primary end, but they haven't cut their defense budget. Because their defense budget is now, the majority of the British defense budget is now going to pay retirees. And that doesn't work real well when the Russians attack. Unless you're willing to come back to active duty, that is, and fight the Russians.
Correct.
Which
Correct.
Might be a little awkward. Anyway.
Okay. As a retiree that went to work right after retired, I know that a lot of my cohorts in the motor pool went and got jobs with government contractors doing the job the civil servants could do in the motor pool.
That's right.
So the same guys that we put out of the Army because they couldn't shave close enough, or their hair was too long, or their belts were not seen or something like that, are back working for contractors, making good money doing the same thing that they used to do in uniform.
You know that those are experts. You knew that, right?
That's your word.
No. What is it? You see, an ex is a has-been, right? Like an ex-wife or an ex-employee. Okay. And a spurt is a drip under pressure. So the definition of expert is a has-been drip under pressure.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much for the call, sir.
And it was sure good to hear from you, Rick. Come by and see us sometime.
Jeff, I've got a cavalry belt buckle for you.
Okay.
I know you still collect that stuff, don't you?
I do.
Okay.
Thank you.
I keep looking at it because if that needs to go to Jeff, you're still in the same office you've been in.
We sure are.
We are in Salado.
In Salado.
Right.
We will have that meeting.
Well, thank you, Rick, and good luck out there. By the way, you taught me something really good, too, and you said never follow closely behind or allow a truck to follow closely behind me. Because you talked about the gators they threw and the fact that the truck drivers were often semi-somnolent in the cab. And I have followed that. I've kept my distance from 18-wheelers ever since. Thank you, Rick.
You're alive and well.
That's it.
I'm assuming you're better now. Like I said, I didn't hear you for a couple of weekends. I'm not home all the time to hear your program, but I always have it on Saturday morning when I am home.
Well, I certainly thank you for your service, too, and for all the help you gave me. Okay. Bye-bye, Rick.
Bye.
And you are absolutely right, old Baldy, Jeff. It was MacArthur that was sitting there. It was 1932, called the Bonus Army, but it's the same.
But it wasn't
concept.
A million. The Million Man March was supposedly black men.
Right, that was a different issue. There was 43,000 marchers, and these were World War One veterans. Mm-hmm. I was thinking it was Civil War veterans, but that was a different issue.
World War One veterans had been promised through the system, but there was no law.
Yeah, a cash payment redemption of their service certificates. But it was a promise without anything to back it up. And
it's very similar, by the way, to the military retirement prior to 62.
Right, and currently, all it takes is Congress to change its mind, to change the law, and that obligation is only an act of Congress.
And this is the odd thing about changing that law. The law that is in place is not being enforced. The law that
is in place
says it's a retainer, and they did call people back to active duty. But the law that was in place actually requires military retirees prior to age 62 to show up regularly for physicals and everything else, to show that they're still capable of going back into combat if need be. And if they did that, I would think there'd be an awful lot of the military retirees who would suddenly stop getting pay, but that wouldn't be politically acceptable.
Right.
Anyway, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Do we have any comicals?
We do have some commercials to play.
All right. Can we play some commercials?
We're going to
do that. We don't have to.
If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with
Jeff
and Jake McClure.
And you need to either let me start that off or you get the rhythm down.
So right.
You have to get the rhythm down, you know. And we're back with more of the wealth.
Right. There's no rhythm in that either.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
See, we've got a lot of practice saying our names that way.
But we got down to practice, so it's not the same thing anymore. Anyway, telephone number in here, 254-773-1400, if you'd like to engage us with witty repertoire.
Or not so witty, if you prefer. Okay. Either way.
A big thing is happening. The first elements of it are going to go into effect in a month or so, and then it's more of it will go into effect on April 10th, and then next year, and then finally by the end of next year will be totally in effect, and it's called the DOL Fiduciary Rule.
That's correct.
And that sounds like a bunch of gobbledygook, except for the fact that
DOL is Department of Labor.
Bank of America's branch called Merrill Lynch, which is no longer a separate company because it really screwed up, has announced that they will no longer allow their salespersons, who they call financial advisors, to sell commissioned products in retirement plans, IRAs, and so on.
There's also a quick move away from the title financial advisor.
Really?
That's going on.
Good.
Yes,
because, I'm glad.
Yeah, me too. We function as fiduciaries for our client, and that functional position falls under a law called the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. And the word advisor, for many years, just like the word engineer, was protected. You had to have a fiduciary status to use it. Not that long ago, about 15 years ago, it started being used, and the SEC said, go ahead, no problem. It started getting used by salespeople. And it really confused the public, and that most people don't know the difference between a financial advisor and an investment advisor.
And Merrill Lynch was the one that pushed the SEC under Chris something or another to allow the use of the term financial advisor, and they had a pretty laissez-faire SEC at the time, and he said, oh, sure, why not?
What's the problem with that? Everybody knows the difference between a financial advisor and an investment advisor. Well,
actually,
it blurred the lines completely.
They didn't. It's just that Merrill Lynch had been a big contributor to this guy when he was a congressman.
Right.
And I don't even remember his last name now. His first name was Chris. But it really blurred the line. Now, for those of you not familiar, the term fiduciary means if a person is a fiduciary, and by the way, you have to be very careful about how you ask this, then they're obligated to work in your best interest. Now, the problem that we run into is a lot of people who are in the financial services industry are part-time fiduciaries. In other words, one moment that person will be a fiduciary working in your best interest, at least theoretically, like the certified financial planner guys out there. I don't know if guy is the right thing. They say certificate.
Yeah, certificates.
Certificates. Is theoretically a fiduciary while discussing your financial plan, but as soon as they talk about the products you put in it, they cease to be a fiduciary, and they become adversarial if they don't tell you this. And there's a difference. If either anyone you're working with in financial services world, or for that matter in the rest of the world too, is either operating in your best interest as a fiduciary, in which case they have really huge liability, or they're operating in an adversarial role as an agent of a company, in which case they don't have the big liability. And they switch back and forth very frequently, and it has caused a lot of confusion.
Continues to cause confusion.
And it was a marketing technique started by Merrill Lynch, who went bankrupt, and I think at least partially because of that. And they've said, hey, no more commissions. Edward Jones has just said that they're not going to allow commissioned mutual funds or any other pooled product in retirement plans.
That's individual retirement accounts, IRAs,
right.
Roth IRAs, traditional IRAs, 401ks, mm-hmm. All that good stuff falls under this rule.
And here's the thing. We've been talking about this for years, how brokers who call themselves financial advisors have huge incentives to sell certain things where they get commissions and free trips and things like that that they don't tell you about. And as a result, in my experience, when I was a broker, this is Jeff, I saw continual pressure to sell very, very, very high commission products that you didn't even realize were high commission products. The non-traded real estate business and the non-traded oil business and all of this have the highest commissions to the point where they're just off the scale. And people were pushed to sell those because the broker-dealer who the person was employed by made more money when these things were sold. And they were hollering at the same time. I got arguments, and there was a big debate going on. We were saying, hey, being fee-only is better for the client. It is better for the member of the public. It is not conflicted. The people who were in the brokerage world said, no. Commissions are actually better. They're less expensive, and they're a better way of getting the money to the people. And now that the DOL has come out and said, well, you have to legally operate in the best interest of a retirement plan beneficiary slash holder, there's been a sudden discovery. Maybe these things aren't in the best interest because all of a sudden, you as a member of the public, starting actually at the end of next year, will be able to sue a broker, financial advisor, who does not act in your best interest. And that has got
It's the beginning
terror.
Of 2018, yeah.
Yeah, at the end of 17. That has got the brokerage world terrified and bolting for the doors and trying to find some way to get around it. And by the way, they have sued the Department of Labor saying we should not, it is illegal that you say that we should operate in our customer or client's best interest, and you've exceeded your authority.
Except that the Pension Protection Act of 2006, it's a law that was passed in 2006.
Right.
It's not new news.
But the financial services, literally the financial services industry in its various organizations, are suing the Department of Labor, saying you have overstepped your bounds by saying that we have to act in our customers' or our clients' best interest. And that should tell you a world about what's going on out there.
Right. The fact that they're having to sue to prevent themselves from operating in your best interest is, well, that's the bottom line.
And there's this, the argument that they have also put forward is that we won't be able to work with low dollar value clientele because we need to charge them high commissions to make it worth us going to them.
My answer to that is baloney.
And it's not true. It's a matter of I'll be very frank with you and say, if you look at where the high-end, high-producing brokers live, and they're right up there with the they make more money than surgeons do. And the high-end retail brokers who sell lots and lots and lots of commissioned product to their clients live at a higher standard of living and a higher income than high-level cancer specialists and high-level physicians. And there's something fundamentally wrong with that.
Yeah.
And this is the beginning of the process of bringing the financial high commission driven business down to earth. And I think the SEC eventually may come around to that. And at present, they only have three commissioners because Congress has blocked the other two. So they have to have pretty much a unanimous agreement to do anything. And one or two of those commissioners are basically in the employ in many ways of the brokerage industry, and they won't allow a fiduciary standard from the SEC. But that's a key thing to be aware of, is that first off, if you need to deal with somebody who's federally regulated, and as much as I don't like regulation, I'm going to tell you this is where we do need it. When we're selling stuff you can't see and won't see the results of for years. And secondly, you need to say, are you willing to be a full-time fiduciary, and put that in writing. It's whatever they say, they can argue they never said.
Yeah, you can say it clearly, the full-time. It means everything you say to me falls under this category. If it doesn't, then you need to tell me when you're not a fiduciary anymore. They don't do that, by the way. Let me stop a moment and say there are a lot, the vast majority even, of brokers out there, salespeople, financial advisors, that are very ethically minded.
Mm-hmm.
They will do what is good for you.
To a degree.
What is good for you, though, is not necessarily what's best for you.
Well, now, they'll do what they believe is good for you.
Right, but they're influenced by how much they get paid.
And they're influenced by the fact that they get their continuing education and they're told about products by going to conferences set up by their employer, the broker-dealer.
In Hawaii. Or in...
Yeah, someplace nice with their girlfriend or their wife or whatever.
Or husband or boyfriend.
Yeah,
you've got to be
whatever.
Even-handed
right.
Here. I mean.
And they're told this is why this is really good for your customers. And they take that back and they tell it to you. And the fact that they get a 7 or that there's a total commission on there that's 10% of what you put in, which makes it really, really hard to recover in a 1% environment in any reasonable period of time. And the fact that what you're buying into may or may not be there, it may or may not be liquid. Very frankly, several major brokerage firms have been hit with big fines because the people who were selling stuff to the public didn't have any clue how dangerous it was because they were never trained on it.
No, they were just told, sell this, it will pay you a lot of money.
Yeah, and it will be good for your clients. And vast majority of them. Now there's
they're not going to sell it if they don't think it's good for the client.
And they think it's really good for you and it's good for them. Matter of fact, I heard this over and again. It's good for your client, it's good for your pocketbook, and it's good for the broker dealer. There's a three-legged stool here, and we have to keep that three-legged stool healthy. It's good for everybody. And everybody makes a lot of money.
Well, the important factor here, and this is important in any business, in order for a business to maintain a healthy relationship with its customer, the customer has to feel like they've got the better end of the deal, and the person selling the thing to the customer has to feel like they've got the better end of the deal. So if you make desks, you're really good at making desks, and you sell it to someone who's willing to pay you more than you would pay for it because you know how to make it.
And there's another argument that you may hear from your broker who calls himself or herself a financial advisor, and that is the people who charge fees wind up charging more money than we charge. And there is that could be an argument. If let's just say you're working with an investment advisor that charges you 1% a year, and you compare that with what another person would charge you who is charging you a 4% upfront commission plus a 0.25% a year. Well, it sounds like the 1% a year is more until you look at the underlying cost of the products they're selling you and you realize that the average mutual fund in the United States charges you 1.4% internally. So you throw that in there and you realize that you're paying 1.4% to the fund company, which, by the way, a lot of that goes back to the broker-dealer.
Right.
And if you go to an investment advisor, they're obligated as a fiduciary to find the least cost way of doing it. And quite literally, sometimes you can get a better performing fund, not the better managed, but better performing, where the internal charges are 0.17% or 0.25% instead of 1.4%. So the net charge you're paying, including the invisible charges, in most, and I would say any reputable, federally regulated investment advisor, by definition, I'm pretty comfortable is going to be charging you less than you're going to pay at a broker. And the reason is,
as long as they're doing just the fiduciary business. They might be doing brokerage and fiduciary.
But if they're not, presuming that they're not doing the brokerage business. And the reason I say that is the imposition of the DOL's fiduciary rule, even though they say they're charging you less, is going to cut, every broker-dealer agrees, and they've all agreed on this point, is going to cut their revenue horribly. So if they were charging you less than the investment advisors, why is becoming a fiduciary going to cut into their revenue horribly and cause many brokers to go out of business?
That's the big thing. If they are charging you less, they would not be getting a pay cut for doing the same thing that they say they're charging less to do.
And I, you know, as much as I don't like the federal government and I don't like regulation, and believe me, I don't, and I don't in many cases, we've been saying something for years, and now the evidence is coming out that what we've been saying is right, that if you can find someone who will be a full-time fiduciary acting on your behalf and not on behalf of a corporation, you'll be better off. And we're still here, aren't we?
Yeah, we want to run to the next subject. I've got something economic-based.
Sure, economic.
Yes, you mentioned it last hour in passing that our unemployment rate was at 5.
Yes.
That is 0.1% higher than it was a month ago or even a week ago.
Right.
That means that more people are looking for work. Now, there's some other numbers that came out at the same time about the number of people that were hired. And on average, it takes about 140,000 people being hired in a given measured period.
Net hired. So all hires minus layoffs.
Right. In order for us to keep up with the population growth and new people coming in from schools and so on, well, we hired 156,000. So that's 16,000 more than to break even. And yet our unemployment rate went up. And to a lot of people, that doesn't make sense. So we're going to tell you why.
He's going to tell. You want me to tell?
We can both do it. I mean, we both know this. So
it's called 3 million.
3 million.
3 million people came out of the unemployed but not looking for work group who previously had worked or were eligible to work. So we had 3 million people in the United States in September who said, guess what, I haven't worked in a long time, but there's enough jobs out there, and they're paying well enough, I think I'll go back to work now.
Right. So that's exactly what I would have said. What we're seeing is that second unemployment rate, something called the U6, the one that the people that are just stopped looking for work, is shrinking faster than the unemployment rate.
And there's another fascinating statistic here. Boy, that's an oxymoron.
Fascinating statistic. How is that even possible?
The highest, if you look at ethnic groups by sex and ethnicity, I love that word, the highest employment rate and lowest unemployment rate is white males. And it's fascinating. Those are the people who are listening, and I'm not trying to negate what's going on in the political realm, but there's this chant of, many people are out of work. We need more jobs. And the need more jobs, at least from the right, is aimed at white males. But the white males are almost fully employed at this point.
Right. And on the other side, on the left side, Hillary Clinton's talking about the separation in wealth. Well, a bunch of numbers just came out about the poverty level shrinking, income levels at the lower end going up faster than the upper end. And this is something we've been predicting for multiple years, saying it's going to happen. This is normal coming out of a recession, especially a big one, that the people that are the wealthiest get there first. Well, now we're coming back together, which is a very normal thing. Incomes at the lower end had to come up. It's been pretty stagnant for a long time. There are multiple reasons for that. Demographics, women coming into the workforce. If you look at the median household income, it's going up, and even with inflation, and this is new stuff.
And the fact that the CEO of Wells Fargo, Mr. Stumpf, has agreed not to be paid for 2 years.
Right. So those pieces are saying that the political debate on the Democrat side is that poor people are getting poorer, and that's reversed. And the political debate on the Republican side is that the white middle class person is being pushed down beneath the boots of the immigrants and everyone else. And that's not reversed. So we're talking about something that took place at the depths of the recession as if they're still important today, because we still feel like they are. But if you look around, you're in a better place than you were, and so are your friends.
And we got 1 minute left.
Yeah, so if you would like to contact us off the air, we've got a webpage that has podcasts and our philosophy, and you can sign up for the newsletter if you'd like. It's great stuff. Old Baldy over here writes it, and it is fantastic. Jeff being Old Baldy.
No, we write it together.
I do get involved.
The original draft.
You're definitely the lion's share of it. That's for sure. So
the liar's share.
Anyway, tpwc.com is our website. You can email us at jake@tpwc.com or jeff@tpwc.com. You can call our phone number and get voicemail during the weekend and real live people during the week. That's locally 254-947-1111 or 1-800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN.
And until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.